This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because it's a place we spend some time in North Dakota. You know, we say hi to folks. They say hi to us. We share news and opinions, and we conduct a business occasionally, and it's just a great place to be, especially on a wonderful summer day. And we're joined now on our Main Street by Sean Sherman. He joins us by phone from the Twin Cities. He is known as the Sioux Chef, and Ashley Thornburg and I are already thinking about food, aren't we?
Hi, Sean. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, guys. Yeah.
And we should point out that a lot of people, when they think sous chef, they go with the French spelling, S-O-U-S, and kind of an assistant. But you are actually the head chef, and we're going with the spelling S-I-O-U-X because your focus is on bringing food back that is traditional Native American food. And I understand it's really thanks to your grandpa that you have a strong interest in food.
Because of my background, you know, growing up on Pine Ridge in general, and just, you know, being a chef in the city for such a long time, you know, it just seemed silly that there were no Native American restaurants anywhere. And I just really wanted to try to, you know, move forward and change that concept because, you know, there's so much awesome food all around us.
Well, how long have you been doing this and what really spurred you to get into it?
Well, I started my company, The Sioux Chef, just recently, this last year in last September. And I started off as catering, and I've been started doing a lot of traveling. I started getting a lot of press because there weren't too many people doing fully traditional foods where, you know, I removed all European ingredients and I was really focused on the wild foods that were all around us and the flavors that were there and what people were growing before Europeans showed up and just really kind of bringing back a lot of these traditional flavors onto the plates. So, you know, right now we're still catering around the city. I'm still doing a lot of traveling, and we actually have a food truck opening up this week called Tatanka Truck. That's going to be on the streets in the cities, and it's focused on that same food style.
So what are some of the ingredients that you are working with now?
Yep, and, you know, and people, there's not a lot of information out there, so people are always kind of confused at first as to what Native American food might be. And, of course, they'll always think fry bread and, you know, maybe buffalo and stuff like that, which is, you know, pretty close. But we went before fry bread came around. So we're using a lot of, well, meats are the easy part. So there's bison, there's venison, there's rabbit, there's duck. We use a lot of the fish that's around this area. So there's walleyes and northerns and whitefish and trout. But, you know, for me, it was really the study of the plants and, you know, the ethnobotany side. So I really wanted to know what people were gathering, you know, all the different berries, flavors from trees. We use a lot of cedar and balsam fir and spruce tips and things like that. We use a lot of dried flowers. We use a lot of we're working with these native run farms, and they're growing out some really cool heirloom varieties. So there's old varieties of corn, beans like Hidatsa bean and Arikara bean, or there's some Lakota squash. There's old sunflower seed varieties. So it's just a lot of really cool stuff that's all around us.
How do you go about researching the foods and, for that matter, the preparation techniques?
You know, the preparation techniques were pretty simple. I've been telling people it's really just like the unmodernist cuisine because it's real simplistic food. It's extremely healthy, you know, because we've cut out all processed sugars and flour and dairy, and we're just using these mostly plant-based foods. So for my research, since there wasn't really like a Joy of Native American Cooking cookbook out there, yeah. I had to kind of, you know, pull together my own research plan. So I started studying wild foods. I started studying ethnobotany, which plants are indigenous to the regions. You know, and I'm really focused on just the region, this region right in particular. So even though I grew up on Pine Ridge and I'm Lakota, Oglala Lakota, I'm focused more on the Ojibwe and Dakota tribes out in this region because I'm just in the forests. Because the food is so extremely regional because it's just what's immediately around you. And so it changes even from, like, I'm doing the dinner here in North Dakota in a few weeks, and that one's going to be more focused on the plains. But, you know, so it just varies so much, you know. But I had to read a lot of history. I've talked to a lot of elders and just really tried to figure out, you know, what were the foundations of Native American cuisine.
Do you have trouble getting your ingredients ever?
You know, everything's so seasonal. So the biggest trick is just being on top of it. So when something comes through, it's really preserving it. And, you know, preserving foods was one of the biggest things for people's back in the old days because we had to prepare for the winter, basically. So there was a lot of sun drying and smoking going on and grinding things into flour and then storing them for the winter use. So as things come through season, it's just trying to grab some stuff, you know, because there's like berry season upon berry season that comes through, especially in the forests here. So grabbing all those kind of things, grabbing some blossoms when they're appearing in the early spring. You know, tinsel has come through in the early part of summer, which are these prairie turnips, basically. So it's just trying to collect these things as they come through and then, you know, being able to save them to utilize them for the rest of the year.
You've got this traditional dinner near Havana, North Dakota, coming up on Thursday, August 6th. Now, Havana is a small town near the South Dakota border. It's near Tewaukan. Have you developed the menu for that yet?
Yep, and they have it on the website, so it's at the Katota Prairie Lodge, and I think it's cdplodge.com is their website. And the web, I'm doing a dinner called Dinner of the Choke Cherry Moon, because that's the Lakota moon for that month, and so I'm using some of my Lakota background for that. But, you know, I was really trying to focus on a lot of the flavors that are right there around that part of South Dakota, just to kind of influence. And this is kind of one of our higher-end dinners. We do a lot of varieties of different kinds of foods, but, you know, this dinner will be a lot more artfully plated and, you know, really focused on the whole event as a big event. You know, it's, you know, there's kind of a showpiece, you know, because we're just going to make the plates look really pretty and everybody get to try all these flavors in different form. And, you know, it's really kind of a presentation dinner.
Do you like the presentation dinners more than food truck or restaurant or, you know, do you like all of them?
I would say it's all different. You know, it's fun as a chef to be creative and to do some of these kind of higher end fancy dinners and really play with, you know, what the plates look like and what the food looks like and making it balance with flavor and texture and color and you making a whole, using all the senses basically to kind of create these art pieces. But it's also so satisfying to do the really simple foods like the food truck where you're just handing out, you know, really quality, good, healthy food. And, you know, you see people being really happy, you know, and our food truck turned out so awesome. You know, people go to tatankatruck.com, they can, you know, find some pictures of it. So, I mean, there's all sorts of food, but like I said, this is like the unmodernist cuisine, so it doesn't have to be fancy at all.
Did pre-reservation Native Americans use a lot of spice?
There's a lot of wild herbs that we utilize into our cooking. So I use a lot of cedar, flat cedar as a spice, as a seasoning. A lot of wild mint, like bergamot and stuff like that we utilize. So there's a lot of flavors out there. We use a lot of dried things like rose hips. We smoke our own salt just because it adds a little extra flavoring to things. So there's quite a bit of flavor profile out there. It's pretty fun.
There have been a lot of health problems that came out of colonization and being stripped from a traditional diet where you said a lot of hunting, a lot of eating locally, a lot of gathering, a lot of eating very nutritious food, and then eating this, you know, government-supplied, not so healthy food. And it's been a problem for a long time on reservations since. Have you been able to do any work back on the reservations and teaching this?
Well, I'm the food truck that I'm working with. I'm working with directly in partnership with the Little Earth community, which is the urban native community within the Minneapolis area. So, and we have people from many tribes all around us. You know, more specifically from the Dakota and Ojibwe tribes around Minnesota. But I've been doing a lot of traveling, so, you know, I'm trying to, you know, I haven't been open that long, but I'm really focused on really getting this food out there because this food isn't about me trying to become a famous chef. It's really about just getting people to change their viewpoint of thinking about what traditional native foods are and making them accessible so they can get them back on people's plates, especially in the native community. Because the best part about this food is it's just so healthy. And by cutting out all that sugar and flour and dairy, it drops the glycemic scale way back down to where it used to be because back in the old days, there was no obesity or tooth decay or heart disease or type 2 diabetes or any of that stuff going on. And it was all because of this really healthy diet that people were on. And, you know, of course, like some years weren't the best, but people were really good about gathering and, you know, whether they were just out there gathering or if there was a lot of agriculture going on, especially in the area that you guys are in. And so, like, you know, processing all the harvest foods and just making sure that they have a huge supply of food to last a long cold winter. But still, the food, even in dry form, you know, is so extremely healthy that, you know, people were just really fit and didn't have all the problems that we see today.
Was that the primary preservation technique, drying the food?
Drying was the biggest one. So, yeah, mostly sun drying was pretty typical, and on occasion utilizing smoke, so smoking techniques, especially with the meats.
How different are the flavor profiles of different indigenous groups, different Native American groups?
Oh, it changes all over the board. I mean, if people looked at the United States as Native America, you would see so many different groups, cultures, religions, and flavors all over the place. You know, I've spent quite a bit of time this winter going out towards California and the summer. And, you know, their style of cooking is so completely different on that side. And the foods are, you know, it's really cool. There's so much food in California, but it's just so different from here. And again, in the Southwest, it's completely different. You know, and even, like I said, from Minnesota to where I grew up around the Black Hills area, it changes so fast in style. So there's many styles all across the United States and even into Mexico. So if you blur the lines of what Mexico and the United States are and you look at just the indigenous peoples, like, you know, the flavors just change so dramatically over just a few hundred miles everywhere you go. So it would be really interesting to see Native American restaurants across the country because it would really showcase, you know, just the regional feel of the United States in general. It would totally change the landscape in the culinary world.
I noticed on your website that there are a number of links to other sort of native preservation efforts, whether it's language preservation or just traditional wild rice harvesting. How would you say that you work with the other organizations doing similar, not necessarily food-based work?
Well, I mean, I think that food is really kind of the center of a lot of pieces of culture. So we're tied in closely with a lot of different people. And I've been really actively trying to help promote other native food producers out there in the States. So we're really trying to utilize, you know, people doing hand-harvested wild rice from Minnesota, people making their own maple. You know, some people are making birch syrups even, people that are collecting wild pieces or indigenous food plant pieces from around the state. Trying to find more indigenous animal, like ranchers, so we can have some of these great, you know, like rabbits and bison and pieces like that. And just really trying to help promote that across the board because it's only going to promote health and it's also really helping to promote more economics, especially in Native communities that could really use some more economics going on.
Now, in every culture, we have some foods that are kind of like acquired tastes. I'm thinking of lutefisk in one culture, for example. Are there any acquired tastes in the that you've come across?
You know, there's the mold that grows on the corn. The Mexicans are pretty comfortable with it. They call it corn smut. They also call it huitecolche in Mexico.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
There's a piece like that. You know, I grew up eating all sorts of, you know, basically I grew up on a ranch on Pine Ridge, but so we ate a lot of beef at the time, but, you know, we're used to eating all parts of the animal. So eventually everything would end up on the dinner table at one point. So we had a traditional soup called taniga that was tough for me as a kid, but I appreciate it so much more now that I'm older. But it was basically, you know, an intestine soup for the most part. So there's pieces here and there that people might be uncomfortable with. And, you know, there's a lot of wild animals that people used to eat that people just don't eat anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was pretty common for moose and bear and squirrel and animals like that, that, you know, would be a pretty like a normal mainstay as part of the diet.
On the reservations you visit, is there interest in rediscovering these traditional foods and preparations?
Yeah, I think people really have a lot of interest because I think people really want to try to regain that knowledge of, you know, just reconnecting with the earth and going back outside and learning and knowing what all the plants are around you. And because it's, you know, there's so much food all around us all the time. And, you know, if people really connected with the earth around them, they could really see that. It's so fun. You go hiking and you just see a huge patch of food here and a huge patch of food there. And it's just, you know, it's just handing it to you, basically. So there's that part, and there's the health aspect part of, you know, just really regaining our health and moving forward into a healthier future and, you know, steering our kids away from diets that are only going to cause diabetes, you know, by the time they're in their late teens even. So there's a lot of important pieces that I think people are really attracted to with the work that I've been doing.
In doing your research, do you find afterwards that you view your own culture differently somehow, or at least deeper?
Definitely, because, you know, I grew up on the reservation just before high school, and I finished high school and college in a town called Spearfish, South Dakota. And, you know, for me, I just, you know, after college, I moved to Minneapolis, and I quickly thereafter started my chef career in Minneapolis, and I worked with many different styles. But, you know, I just, after I really started getting into this idea of doing Native American foods, you know, all the other fads and everything else out there just kind of fell away, because this was, you know, so much bigger than me and so much more real. And it just had, and there was so much more knowledge to it all. I was just, you know, it was really captivating the more I learned, and I'm still learning it. I wouldn't call myself an expert by any means. I just, you know, I spent quite a few years studying to get to the point where I felt like I could start to come out and be able to do, you know, Native American foods. And I have to put a little bit of a modern twist to it. But, you know, for me, it was just wiping away the European ingredients and looking at what the foundations and pillars of Native American food systems were, and just utilize these foods alone to build everything.
Well, again, this traditional dinner is coming up near Havana, North Dakota, Thursday, August 6th. If somebody is interested in attending, what do they have to do, and how much does it cost?
Well, they could look up the Katota Prairie Lodge, which is where the event will be held, and they have the website. Like I said, I think it's cdplodge.com. There'll be a link on my website at sue-chef.com, and people can always find me on social media. They can find my Facebook account for The Sue Chef, also Twitter and things like that. All of our social media should have links and information on how to find tickets to this dinner. And, you know, this dinner is a little bit, I think it's $75 per person, so it's a little bit on the high end, but, you know, it's something completely unique, so it should be pretty cool.
When you're not cooking with indigenous ingredients, what do you like to prepare?
You know, I keep it simple. I mean, I'm at the co-ops all the time, so I just really love getting all the fresh foods that are coming through in season. You know, I have I get what's called a TSA instead of a CSA from one of the local farms, and that's tribally shared agriculture.
Sure.
is the kind of twist on it a little bit. So I just, you know, just really love cooking with the fresh foods for the most part.
Well, when are we going to see your cookbook? We're all intrigued by maybe putting some of this together ourselves.
Yeah, well, I just signed a cookbook deal, so I'm starting to work on that. And with another author by the name of Beth Dooley, and we should hopefully have this cookbook, you know, finished, and the University of Minnesota will be publishing it, and you know, it might be a year and a half, 2 years, but it's in the works, and it's basically focused on just dealing with the understanding of what Native American food systems are.
Well, thank you for spending some time with us, Sean.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, guys.
Sean Sherman is the Sue Chef, and you can find out more at sue-chef.com, and that meal at the lodge at cdplodge.com. Coming up next, a story from Harvest Public Media. Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with 2 hours of Antiques Roadshow, episodes called Vintage Madison and Vintage Tampa. Then at 9 Central, Prairie Mosaic, featuring regional artists and performers. And at 9:30, Music Voyager travels to the Bahamas. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and that Native American flute music in the background is Keith Bear. He's playing the Walking on the Water tune, and this was actually recorded at Makoche Studios in Bismarck. Farmers are in a never-ending battle with weeds. Their main weapons are chemical herbicides, but could exposure to those chemicals create some health problems? Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports on what scientists have to say about two of the most heavily used farm chemicals.
Nathan Dorn is scouting for weeds in a strip of grass between a field of corn and a field of soybeans. He rips a leafy green stalk out of the ground by its roots.
Pigweed. This is pigweed.
Dorn farms with his family here in southeast Nebraska. And one thing he says the family won't tolerate is weeds.
You break it apart there, you know, what do you see there? What is that?
It's wet.
Yeah, that's moisture. I mean, that's moisture that this plant's using to grow that's not in there for my corn, not in the ground for my soybeans.
That's why before he plants his crop, Dorn sprays the field with a herbicide cocktail. Each acre is sprayed twice, some three times, to wipe out weeds. Corn and soybean farmers in the U.S. put down more than 300 million pounds of herbicide each year to keep their fields clean.
You know, you got to make sure that you have crops in your field and not weeds, because weeds don't end up in the combine bin. Weeds don't pay the bills.
But is all that spraying safe? In the last few months, scientists from around the globe weighed in on two of the most important herbicides to U.S. farmers, glyphosate and 2,4-D. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, or IARC, is part of the World Health Organization. IARC brings in scientists to evaluate data on different chemicals and decide if there's evidence they could cause cancer. They looked at glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup, and determined it probably could cause cancer. For 2,4-D, which has been on the market since the 1940s, the group said it was possible the chemical could cause cancer. Environmental groups want regulators in the U.S. to take notice. Here's Scott Faber of the Environmental Working Group.
IARC is the decision-making body to which every regulator around the world looks to.
IARC doesn't regulate herbicides itself, but the agency's decisions do carry weight. Brazil is taking another look at glyphosate. It was already under review in this country by the Environmental Protection Agency. Farmers fighting herbicide-resistant weeds likely will look to spray more chemicals, not less. That's why Faber says the EPA needs to take IARC's conclusions into account when deciding how much is safe, both for farmers and their neighbors.
There are millions of rural residents who use playgrounds and go to school or go to church within the drift zones of corn and soybean fields.
But the EPA doesn't look at herbicides the same way as IARC. Take the case of 2,4-D. Ana Claire de Roos is an epidemiologist at Drexler University and was a member of the 2,4-D group at IARC. She says the group's job was only to ask whether a chemical is a potential hazard.
Is there enough evidence to say that this agent or chemical causes cancer? And if so, what types of cancer is there sufficient evidence for?
So 2,4-D is a possible carcinogen, but so are coffee and aloe vera, according to IARC. The EPA's job is to determine whether it's likely to cause cancer or if there's a safe way to use it in the real world.
They also try to characterize what is the dose response, how much exposure do you need in order to develop cancer.
Julie Goodman is a toxicologist and consultant who works with the chemical industry. She says 90 government agencies around the world have done risk assessments on 2,4-D and found it safe to use.
Farmers or anyone else using or potentially exposed to 2,4-D should really rely on the results of the risk assessments. And as I said, these risk assessments demonstrate that 2,4-D does not increase cancer risk.
In the end, the real risk from any chemical is tied to the dose. That's up to the EPA and farmers like Nathan Dorn. He's comfortable following EPA guidelines, and that means he'll keep using chemicals like glyphosate and 2,4-D as long as they keep killing weeds.
It's effective, and you know what you're going to get. Right or wrong, it works.
For now, those tools will stay in his toolbox, at least until the EPA releases its review of glyphosate. That's expected to come out this summer. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media reports on Prairie Public are supported by the North Dakota Farmers Union. Coming up on Main Street, we'll find out about Capitol Shakespeare on the Capitol grounds in Bismarck. And we'll also talk with one of those pitchmen at the North Dakota State Fair and, of course, our Dakota date book. But right now, the news with Todd.
Thank you, Doug. The number of airline boardings in North Dakota has dropped slightly in the first 6 months of 2015 compared to the same period 1 year ago. State Aeronautics Commission Director Kyle Wanner says boardings dropped by about 1%. He says Dickinson, Williston, Minot, and Fargo saw slight drops and says Bismarck and Grand Forks saw modest increases. But he says Jamestown and Devil's Lake saw significant upticks in passenger numbers And Wanner says that's because both cities now have jet service.
You know, and there's more seats, it's reliable service. I think that was really the kicker for those two communities is that it's reliable. Because previously, with the previous airline provider, it just wasn't so, and people knew that. And so they would drive to Fargo or Bismarck or Grand Forks or Minot, for that matter. And now those people in those communities know that they have reliable service at a good price, and they can fly a jet direct to Denver. They have free parking when they get to the airports, and it's just a less hassle than potentially going to other airports. And so they like that, and that helps increase those numbers.
Wanner says even with the small reductions, 2015 should be the second busiest on record, with 2014 being the busiest. An interim legislative committee will continue a study of behavioral health issues in North Dakota. Those are issues surrounding mental health and substance abuse. The study will be done by the Interim Human Services Committee. Fargo Democratic Representative Kathy Hogan chairs that committee.
This is a long-term process. We're going to build an infrastructure of care for individuals who have either mental health or substance abuse issues, children all the way to geriatrics. It's a big, big challenge. And hopefully we'll build a system that over the next 4 to 6 years will improve the quality of life for people.
In the last interim, a consultant helped study the issue and where North Dakota needs improvement and offering treatment. Hogan says the 2015 legislature passed some bills to start dealing with the issue, but there's more work to do. And Greg Gust, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Grand Forks, is in the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan for a couple weeks. He joined a team of experts helping develop an agricultural weather forecast system.
They're the breadbasket of Central Asia, and after they broke off from the Soviet Union, they lost all their centralized farming, centralized processes that went on there. So they kind of went back to a little bit of more subsistence agriculture for a while. Now they're trying to build back up, developing their own weather service and those activities to support agriculture.
The program is run by the U.S. State Department. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're joined now by Aaron Weichel, the artistic director of the Capital Shakespeare Company in Bismarck, and Emily Riegler, the board president of that organization. They join us from Bismarck. Good to have you with us.
Hello. Good to be here.
Okay. Hey, Emily, let's start with you. I assume both of you were kind of there on the ground floor. This organization's been around for, what, about 7 years?
We started in 2008, so it's, let me do the math.
That comes to 7 years.
7 years, yes, 7 years. And I've been involved for probably, I've been acting with the organization for 7 years now. And I've been involved with the board of directors for about 6 years and board president for about four.
Well, Aaron, you were there too?
I've been here since the beginning, yep. I was.
Well, how did it get started?
It was a group of young women in Bismarck who wanted North Dakota to have a Renaissance fair or something with Shakespeare in it, because we were one of the few states that didn't have that. And so they got together and they met with Dan Rogers, who said, well, I have a former student that's coming back this summer. Let's see if she'll direct. And I came back and I directed once for them, thinking I was going to go back to New York City where I was living at the time. And I've been here ever since. So I just couldn't quite leave it. It's just such a fantastic company, and we do so much great work, and I just love what we do every summer.
Well, Emily, you're the board president, so kind of where the buck stops. How is this supported?
Well, it's supported through a lot of grants. We have lucky to be partners with the North Dakota Council on the Arts, the North Dakota Humanities Council, as well as sponsorships through local businesses. We've had a lot of support from Community Options and
Bismarck State College.
Yes, Bismarck State College, of course, has been huge, huge help throughout the years, as Dan Rogers, recently retired, a professor of theater there, has been involved since the very beginning.
So you collaborate with Bismarck State College, and now let's talk about this new venue, because A Comedy of Errors, one of Shakespeare's early plays, a kind of farcical, it's a short play as well, opens this week. It runs from Wednesday through Sunday. The a curtain or the sun or the people walk out on stage at 7 o'clock that evening through Sunday. Why was this particular show picked, Aaron?
over the past few years, we've kind of done heavier shows, and this there's nothing heavy at all about this production. From the minute it starts until we get going to the end, it's just one ridiculous situation after another, and it's just fun. And it was Shakespeare's first and only attempt at a farce, and the physical comedy of it is so brilliant, as well as the wit in all of the language that he uses.
Yeah, there's slapstick in this. There are puns and wordplay, of course. And it's the comedy of errors is about two sets of twins separated at birth, and you can imagine all the various ways that can get humorous. Talk about the venue, though. I started with that, about this new Prairie Amphitheater.
Yes. When the Heritage Center did their expansion and their remodeling of their existing space, on the outside of the new entrance, which is like just south of the new entrance where they have the copper on the walls, there is a naturally sloped amphitheater. And so we're down at the bottom of the hill, and the audience gets to sit above us like you would in a normal theater, and gets a better, the acoustics are so much better, as well as the sight lines. There's not as much noise from the road and from the surrounding area, and it feels more like a true theatrical experience.
How would you describe your approach to this production?
Bigger is better.
Okay.
Whenever we were doing comedy or anything with the physical and the slapstick, they would ask, is that too much? And I'd say, no, you can go further. And they didn't quite believe me. And then I said, we're going Charlie Chaplin with this. Mm-hmm. And then they all jumped on board and had a better idea of how far we could go with some of it. But the farce nature of it, it's got a, you know, it goes bam, 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 bam. And then there's a moment, and then the big, you know, humorous thing happens. So you've got to find a way to pause just long enough to get the ridiculousness and then make everybody laugh.
Okay. Emily, you're in this show. What's your role?
I am. I play Luciana, who is the sister to Adriana. And Adriana is married to one of the twins who are both named Antipholus. I get very confused because the man that I think is my sister's husband expresses some interest in me. But it turns out, of course, that he is not my sister's husband. He is my sister's husband's twin. So it's okay. But at the moment, I get quite upset.
Okay. Talk about performing outside, both of you, because you've both done it, Aaron and Emily.
It's a challenge.
It is. The biggest thing I have to tell the actors is find a way to pause for airplanes and for any sort of siren going by.
Fire trucks,
ambulance. We're on the hospital route, so it usually happens at least two performances a year. But that's been a challenge. And then the wind. People always ask why we don't microphone. And I'm like, well, if I put a microphone, all you'd hear is that wonderful North Dakota wind.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a company of actors that perform from year to year, or you audition freshly for each season?
We audition fresh each season, but usually it's the same actors that come back, and then we, you know, add in a couple new faces every year. Over the years, we've kind of created a core of about 12 to 15 actors, and every year we add in a new face. So sometimes I'll have people who've never been on stage before and acting alongside people who have masters in theater. And that's always interesting. They both learn a lot from each other, which is fun for me as a director, because I just kind of let them play and they figure it out.
Well, in university theater, typically, which is, I assume, your background, typically you've got performers who are roughly the same age playing a variety of ages. But now you probably can literally cast people to age, can't you?
Yes, I can. My youngest cast member this year, I think, is 17, and my oldest is in their 60s, I'm thinking. So we've got quite the age range, which is nice because, you know, it's kind of weird to watch a 20-something person play the father or mother of another 20-something person. They just don't quite have the life experience for that. So we get the joy of having people of varying ages to play the correct age, as well as play with the wonderful language of Shakespeare.
Well, I know, Aaron, that you went to Minnesota State University Mankato, and actually you were at with Straw Hat one year, I believe, at Morehead State as well.
Yes.
Emily, do you have some background in this art form?
Yeah, I studied theater all throughout college at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. I didn't actually walk away with a degree. My practical side of my brain won out, and I didn't actually get my degree in theater, but I spent a lot of time at the theater.
Well, before 2008, there was no capital Shakespeare, so would the two of you just talk about how you would describe the theater scene in Bismarck now?
It's grown a mm-hmm. lot over the past few years. And I think, you know, the thing that we're very passionate about is not only bringing, you know, Shakespeare to the public, but bringing it to the entire public. And our performances are free for that very reason. We want everyone to be able to experience theater. Theater in cities can get so expensive so quickly. And it's important for us to keep the spectrum wide so that people can enjoy theater. You know, you can just walk from your backyard if you live near the Capitol and just come on over and catch a show. And it's not hard. It's not challenging. It's super accessible. And you learn a little bit when you're exposed to that language. You know, kids are forced to read it in high school, but Shakespeare's meant to be performed, not meant to be read.
Right.
Of course, you know, his impact on the English language is why they are forced to read it. But through those live performances, you learn so much more about how clever he was and how he layered language to create almost motion in the language that you can emphasize on stage. So it's pretty great.
Well, again, it's a comedy of errors. That is the Capital Shakespeare performance this week. Starts Wednesday, runs through Sunday. It's at 7 o'clock. But you also have this traveling troupe thing. Talk about that.
That's a new addition this year. We brought in Amanda Perry, who had been working with Shade Tree for many years. And what she does is she takes a Shakespearean show and she finds an adaptation or a cutting of it that's friendly to students the ages of 12 to about 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put some modern translation in here and there to help make sure that everybody's on the same page and understanding what's going on. And then there's some music in it as well. And they perform traveling around the city. So there's some performances at the zoo. They're at the public library. They're around in some parents' yards. They get everybody in the neighborhood to come over, and they set up chairs in their yard, and they perform there. And it's a great first step for a lot of kids into Shakespeare as a performer. And we really are excited to have them as a part of our company in the hopes that those kids will then almost graduate into what we are now calling the Big Kid Show, which is our main stage production. And so we're really excited. They're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream or The Night They Almost Missed the Forest for the Trees. And it's quite clever. I think Shakespeare would be very proud of the way it was adapted to make sure that the language is still there, but that everybody's getting a chance to understand what's being said.
Well, you've got, five performances of A Comedy of Errors coming up. That's a lot of work for five shows.
It is. We've been in rehearsal since the beginning of June. We auditioned at the last week of May, but I think I've been working on the show forever. But it's a labor of love. I love doing it. And this show was probably one of the easiest to cut that I've ever done because it was already so short.
Mm-hmm.
The only complicated thing was cutting it to make sure, because the two sets of twins are only played by two actors instead of four. So they play their own twin.
Okay. that almost makes sense, actually.
It does. And I think for the audience, it will make more sense than if we had tried to find two actors who kind of look alike, because there's so much mistaken identity that's hard for you to believe. So I cut it so that they could play their own twins, and then every once in a while I was like, oh, how am I going to fill this gap so they can do a costume change? But between myself and the actors, we figured out ways to add in some stage play to give them a chance to get around and change and come back on stage.
Well, you did call this a labor of love. Most theater actually is. People kind of get into it pretty deeply. But how do you make your living otherwise? I mean, It's hard to make a living in theater in Bismarck, I suspect. So, Erin, what's your day job?
I'm a teacher. I teach middle school and high school choir, and I coach the speech team, and I direct the theater department at Shiloh Christian School in Bismarck. So I do theater year-round. I usually direct anywhere from 4 to 5 productions a year, two of which are usually musicals.
Okay.
And that's my day job.
Emily, how about you?
My day job, I'm an office manager for Prairie View Landscaping in Bismarck. So that's my day job, and I'm actively year-round involved on the board of Shakespeare, and I also do some work with Dakota Stage here in town, acting, directing, light designing. So I don't get the opportunity to do as much theater as Aaron does because it's not a part of my day job, but I make room for it when I can.
Well, let's talk about your goals for Capital Shakespeare. What's your vision, say, 5-10 years down the road?
Oh, I have so many dreams. We're really working towards becoming a semi-professional company so that we can pay actors as well as bring in guest performers. There's so many plays that we would like to do, but we can't do because we need a very specific actor or someone who can handle, say, like King Lear. That's a huge responsibility. So we're hoping to get to the point that we can start bringing in regular guest artists, similar to what Northern Plain does, Plains Dance does when they bring in guest dancers, so that the cast would be primarily Bismarck natives, but then one or two people would be from the outside. We also want to keep expanding our educational side of our company. Right now, I go into schools and teach master classes in Shakespeare and in performance, and we'd like to expand that programming so that there's multiple people going out on behalf of Capital Shakespeare into the schools all over the state of North Dakota teaching about Shakespeare and his language.
Well, for our listeners who want to find out more, just Google Capital Shakespeare. That's capital O-L, because that's where the capital is, after all. And you'll find out all kinds of information. Aaron Weichel, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Aaron is the artistic director, and Emily Riegler is the board president. Emily, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up next, well, last Friday was the opening day of the North Dakota State Fair, which continues through this Saturday, and I visited one of the commercial buildings to find a pitch man to talk about life on the road. That conversation is next on Main Street.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, behind the scenes at the secret talks before the Iran nuclear negotiations, plus how a couple of young surfers found a desert island with the perfect wave.
The fishermen we got to take us to this little uninhabited island, they'd never seen a surfboard before, and they didn't believe that we could stand up on them. They thought they were airplane wings.
I'm Renee Montaigne, a surfing memoir on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm in the commercial building at the State Fair in Minot, and we're talking with Mark Carter.
Yes, sir. Mark Carter here.
And Mark, what do you do here? What are you selling?
I'm selling a handmade German cookware called Titanium Elite.
And how long have you been doing this?
This is my 31st summer working the fairs.
How'd you get started?
Through a friend's father, back when I was a young man of 14 years old. I was selling yo-yos, actually, on the streets of New York. And he saw me and thought I would be perfect for this type of profession.
Well, give me the ups and downs of this kind of profession.
Ups and downs. A lot of travel is good, but also can be bad. Living out of a suitcase gets extremely boring after a while. But you get to meet a lot of interesting people. So I do enjoy that.
And what's the circuit like? This is your first of the year?
This is my first fair of the season. But I go coast to coast. So from here, I go to Wisconsin, to the Wisconsin State Fair. Then I go down to the New York State Fair. Then I'm all the way over to Oklahoma and Raleigh, North Carolina, and Texas. And so you kind of zigzag back and forth, kind of like a carny, a little bit of roaming. But it's fun.
And when you're not doing the circuit, what are you doing?
Fish.
You're fishing?
I love to fish. I live down in Florida. So when I'm not on the road, you can find me out on the ocean on my boat.
And what is it about this cookware that makes it sellable?
Oh, it is by far the best cookware you'll ever lay your hands on. Nothing sticks to this cookware. It works. It has the weight of a cast iron pan, but you never need to use any oil, butter, or fat unless you want your food to taste good.
So when you're in the commercial building and a crowd starts to build, how do you work it? What's your strategy?
I don't really approach it with a strategy. I do it more on a friendly basis. I'm just here to talk about what the cookware can do. It's very low key, no pressure whatsoever. I just enjoy talking to the public and showing them what my product can do.
And when did you find out about this product?
A friend of mine actually was a sales rep for this company for quite some time and was trying to get me to come along, and I kept saying no, no, no. And he put one of the pans in my hand and said, go home with it, cook on it. And that night I threw every other piece of cookware I had out, and I started cooking everything I could in that one little pan, even if it took me three or four. Like, instead of using three pans, I would cook each dish individually in that one pan, because there's nothing better than this cookware. It goes in the oven, it goes on your stove, it goes in the dishwasher. They're virtually indestructible.
Well, you're working on selling me here.
No, I'm not doing that.
Now, is this the only way this kind of cookware is sold, or are there other ways too?
No, we strictly sell by live demonstration. Or you can purchase on the internet. But if you purchase on the internet, you're going to be spending a lot more money than if you come out at the fair. We give you a fantastic deal when you come see us live at the show.
And what are you doing with that pan now?
I'm melting sugar. I'm caramelizing sugar so I can pour it over top of these apples and make a candied apple for my display.
Okay. When you're doing this, do you typically run across a lot of the same people or not?
There's different circuits depending on what part of the country you're in. Generally, yeah, vendors go from one show to the next to the next, so it becomes kind of like a family. And we do zigzag back and forth. Some go one way, some go the other, but you usually meet up with quite a few of the same people.
And when you've been doing this for as long as you have, do you have some sort of you have the same location every year or that kind of thing?
Absolutely. We try to have the same location from year to year. That way, the customers have an easy way to find us.
And how about whether there might be competing products in the same building? Is that controlled in any way?
Some fairs, yes. Some fairs, no. There is no competition for what I have. Nobody else sells anything like it. There is other cookware on the market, but nothing quite like this.
So you can fish when you're not doing this. This is a pretty good living?
I do fairly well. I can't complain. I'm not going to be a millionaire, but I live comfortably.
But having this kind of itinerant lifestyle, do you have a family?
Yeah, my wife travels with me. She's here at the fair selling another product. So that's how we actually met, was on the road. She was working for one company. I was working for another. And as they say, it's all history from there.
So what is she selling?
She's got a brand new product this year at the fair, which I think is going to be fantastic for the North Dakota people, because it's a brand new type of space heater. It only costs 19 cents an hour to run. It doesn't heat the room. It heats objects. It kind of works like a microwave as opposed to an oven. So it's a whole new it's also in the Commercial One building. She's got a table with the base as the heater. So when you sit around it, your legs are nice and warm. Then she's got one on a tripod, and she's got a handheld. It's pretty interesting.
I went by it. So when you go around the commercial building, are you looking at stuff?
Absolutely. I'm always looking for what's new and what's out there. And, you know, salesmen are usually the best customers because we always go for a good buy.
Well, these days, when you're looking at trends in commercial buildings at fairs and things like that, besides cookware, What's coming on?
You know what? This year, that heater's real new. There's some new toys at the fair that I've seen that I haven't seen before that are kind of cool for Christmas that's coming up. This thing right across from me, that stretch lid, that's pretty interesting. Instead of using saran wrap, that looks like an interesting product. So it's reusable as opposed to throwing something away, which is better for the environment. I like that idea, too.
Now, when you're starting, when you're trying to build an audience here, do you work on one person and hope that a couple more gather, or how do you do it?
Yeah, absolutely. It only takes one to get started, and generally, I always tell the first person that stops, no obligations to buy anything. The show is free, and once you get the first person, people generally usually fall into line and will stand there and watch, and it's just to put on a nice little show for them. It's not necessarily to sell something. It's to entertain them at the same time.
Now, I'm looking at your jacket here. It says Chef Mark. You like to cook.
I do. I actually did go to culinary school. I love to cook. It is a passion of mine. But I don't actually work in any restaurants. I just sell pots and pans now.
Right. Well, bon appetit and good fortune to you, Chef Mark Carter.
Thank you. Nice meeting you.
Thank you. Support for this program is provided by Elim Rehab and Care, providing transitional care from hospital to home in a comfortable Eden Alternative environment. Further information available at elimcare.org/Fargo.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 20th. Barnum and Bailey Circus pulled into Fargo on this date in 1907, and it would soon experience a menagerie of mishaps. Early in the morning, the circus arrived from Ortonville, Minnesota, in four trains. 20 tents were pitched at the showgrounds near present-day Fargo North High School. The big top was 643 feet high and held 15,000 people. Horses, seats, elephants, and camels comprised the exciting show, along with clowns, ski sailors, and Isabel Butler's Dip of Death. Unfortunately, excitement also came when a section of seating collapsed, hurling 300 people to the ground. Six people were slightly injured, including a Fargo judge who clung to a tent pole and scratched his chin as the seats fell. One woman's spine was injured severely enough that she sued the circus. A railroad agent was also injured, spraining his ankle. He settled with the show people to keep the issue out of court. That was not all, however. A camel died from pneumonia the evening of the show. Worth $2,500, the animal was buried in the Fargo City dump at the edge of town. Forum reporters speculated its carcass would be a mystery to those excavating the land 100 years in the future, in 2007. That wasn't the first time a visiting circus had encountered problems. An acrobat died from typhoid fever in 1905, and a camel was killed by an elephant in 1900. In 1897, a circus was stranded in Fargo due to a lack of funds. Despite all the extra excitement, Fargo continued to be a popular stop on the Midwestern show circuit 100 years ago. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Tuesday on Main Street, the just-released Kids Count Data Book from the Annie E. Casey Foundation provides a glimpse into the well-being of North Dakota children, and we'll discuss the many findings of the report with Karen Olson. She is the Program Director for Kids Count in North Dakota. Also, Bob LaFleur grew up in North Dakota. He went on to a college teaching career. Now he's in retirement, and he's been able to focus his attention on his love of writing. He will join us to talk about his new book, Spider and Other Stories. And, of course, we'll have part three of our Lost Writers of the Plains series, and we'll learn about Dorothy Thomas from producer Robin Murray. So that's all coming up on Main Street Tuesday. In the meantime, we hope you have a great evening.